Annette Gordon Reed has joined us in conversation. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Professor Reed. Well, I guess you're Professor Gordon Reed, be absolutely.
Get the Gordon in there. Yeah, yeah.
You kept it. I should, too. I know that name from somewhere. The notion of property in the United States is absolutely central, and the idea of private property. And going back through all of this story, whether you're talking about the intermarriage of cousins within the white community, of what did and did not apply, all the way through the Hemingses of Monticello, an American family is this very strong strain of the role of private property.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, it's the engine that ran that society. People were concerned about property was connected to a notion of independence. People who had property could vote. They were seen as having a stake in society. And it's something that determined marriage and how people related to one another. And it's not to say that property isn't important for us now, but it was central to people's understanding of the political system, because people who didn't have property at that time could not vote. And for women, if you think about women who, when they married, their property came under the control of husbands and so forth. So, I mean, Washington married up. George Washington married one of the richest, probably the richest widow in Virginia, and becomes sort of attached to his sort of his personal accomplishments, all of a sudden has a major stake in society, and Jefferson a similar thing as well. So property runs throughout all of this in ways, very, very open too, in ways that we don't tend to think about today.
Here's another, I just can't not talk about this. You mentioned David Blight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think of it in the context of the, you talk about when Jefferson's property had to be sold off, mm-hmm. and the property included, of course, his slaves. One of the executors refused to sell a group of them to a buyer from Georgia,
mm-hmm.
Because it was just unacceptable, the conditions. It's the old notion of being sold down river.
Mm-hmm.
David Blight comes up in this context because there has been a major effort since the end of the Civil War, mm-hmm. and it hasn't gone away. I still know people. I can walk with, you know, four blocks from here and have this conversation that have redefined what slavery was all about, mm-hmm. particularly in the South. Mm-hmm. And part of it is a consequence
deep
of
South.
The Deep South. And part of it, of course, is a consequence of the Civil War. But the revisionist tendencies in American history have been, in some ways, very successful. And part of, again, what to me is valuable about this book and several others that have been written is that it demythologizes the revisionist history that we've been we've had to cope with since the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Was that part of the agenda that you had in writing this?
Well, it's not something that I thought of as a plan, but it's just the way I think about things. I mean, this is my understanding of what happened there and what is going on. And there is a sense of trying to make slavery something else, because people don't want to admit that their ancestors did something wrong. You know, I mean, it's a hard thing to do, but it's interesting that in other countries, people, I mean, certainly the Germans and other places, people have really thought seriously about their history. The Japanese, I mean, for the long time, they ignored this, but I think even the Japanese are beginning to come to grips with World War II and so forth. So this notion of sort of squarely facing the past and sort of recognizing that, you know, this was not a good thing, and this was a terrible thing. It was a terrible injustice. And certainly what happened after slavery, when there was a chance to remake the society and say, okay, for whatever it was before, we're going to go forward. And there were people who wanted to do that, and more people who did not. And so we postponed really trying to sort of put America on a good footing by holding on to those sort of mythologies about what slavery was about.
Well, I grew up in the South. You grew up in the South, a mm-hmm. different variation of it. And these stories are not without consequences. These mm-hmm. stories, at least in my experience, were used to support and sustain, you know, a fairly virulent form of racism. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well into the 50s, 60s, 70s, and you can find it even today. Mm-hmm. I think of Confederates in the Attic as an example of that. So it's the stories we tell are very, very, very important.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's important to tell as close as we truthful stories. I won't say true, but stories that are truthful.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, it's the stories you tell. I mean, that sets your understanding of who you are, who your country is, and where you are, and where you're supposed to go, the kind of responsibilities you have as an American for going forward. And to the extent that people are making slavery something, a benevolent institution or a paternalistic institution, or it was good for black people, or slave owners in, you know, there were slave owners in Africa. I mean, well, we can go talk to them, too. I mean, the point is that
It's still a bad idea,
whether it was in Africa, whether it was, I mean, there were slaves, then people say there was slavery in Europe. I mean, unfree people there, anytime.
And there's slavery today.
And there's slavery today. Anytime someone takes this inordinate amount of power over other individuals, there's a problem. And there's no way to pretty that up.
And pretty up you don't, but you do expand the story to be inclusive of things that we just hadn't thought about before. We'll be back for a few more minutes with Annette Gordon-Reed. We trust you'll be with us.